All right, guys, here we are with Dr. Ali Rizvi. Unbelievably excited to host him. First, say hello to the folks. Ali.
Hi, everybody, and hi, God. I mean, I'm with the Godfather. It's an honor. And I don't know what this is. I said before, we're gonna be on split screen, so I know that I'm just gonna. There's no competition whatsoever when it comes to the looks thing either. So it's gonna be
Well, let
tough.
me tell you, by looking on the amount of people that read your Huffington Post articles, I think that might compensate for anything that I do better than you.
Nothing compensates for being absolutely drop-dead gorgeous. Nothing does.
Well, aren't you sweet?
Thanks.
So what I wanted to first maybe begin, first I should mention that the way that I originally heard of you is that I saw some of your sort of your string of unbelievably powerful and elegantly argued articles on Huffington Post, which I should say from the offset that everybody should go to your site, your Huffington Post site, and read your articles because you have a very reasoned, dispassionate way of tackling through very, very difficult issues. So I wanted to get that out of the way first.
Well, thank you.
So that's how we originally met. Then we became friends on Facebook, communicated many times. I was supposed to meet you at the Imagine No Religion conference, but
Yes.
I'll be elegant and say that they it didn't work out for reasons that are out of my control, and I'll leave it at that. But maybe we could start with, I think a lot of people would be interested in your personal history because I know that you were born somewhere, then moved to other places, sort of to give a sense to people of your history. So take it away.
I'll go with that sort of like form that you just put out. So I was born in Lahore in Pakistan. Like the name is Urdu. It's not French, Lahore. I mean, I know that people say that, but so yeah, I was born there. And then when I was just a few months old, my family moved to Tripoli in Libya, and we were in Libya for several years. And after that, we moved to Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And I was there for, I pretty much grew up there as a kid from something like second grade all the way to high school. And then I went to Pakistan, back to Pakistan, this time to Karachi for medical school. And then after that, I came to Canada and then to the US for another 5 years when I did residency. And then I came back to Canada again. Been here ever since. So it's been pretty much everywhere, and I've visited like the Middle East, pretty much all over the place.
Do you speak Arabic?
This is a funny thing. It's just in Saudi Arabia, the locals and the expatriates are so, it's pretty much completely segregated. So you have people who grow up in Saudi Arabia their entire lives, and they come out, they don't know any Arabic.
Wow.
Now I can, however, I did get some basic first grade lessons, so I can say things like "Ana ahibb al-moz,"
I like bananas.
I like bananas, yeah. So that, or "Abi fi aini ahsan ab," my father in my eyes is a very good father.
Yes.
Just the regular stuff you learn first grade. But after that, I could read it. I can read Arabic. I can even write a lot of it. I mean, we had Quran lessons, but just like the vast majority of Muslims in the world, I can read Arabic, but I don't know a lot of times what it means.
Or, of course, in many cases, you have, and you probably would know this, you have a hafiz, somebody which literally means somebody who
Memorizes,
memorizes, right? So
right.
a hafiz in the sense of the Quran is somebody who's memorized every single word of the Quran. Now, what's incredible, and as a psychologist, it's very interesting to kind of comment on that
Right.
in terms of the memory feat. It's somebody who memorizes phonetically every single word without speaking a word or understanding a word of Arabic. It's extraordinary, right?
It is extraordinary. But you know what's funny is, so I have limited experience with this in the sense that I did memorize up to half of Surah Baqarah. That is not even a tenth of the Quran. It's the longest surah in the Quran. It's the second chapter, pretty much. And I did memorize the second the half of it in Arabic, with the pronunciation. But you know what makes it easy to memorize? Like what we literally used to. We had a Quran teacher, and I used to learn like the first two or three lines, say them over and over again. And every day, I would just learn two lines. I'd read whatever I knew until then, and then read the next two lines. That's it. And that's how we did it. It was a very slow process. But the thing that made it easy to memorize is that I also play music, and a lot of the Quran is poetry. As you know, it's
Right.
sung. Let me
Yes.
say recited. It's not sung because music is haram,
Right. Of course.
but it is sung. It's in scale. So it's like, you know, when you think of your songs in high school that you haven't heard for years, and then suddenly you hear it and you just know all the words,
right?
You know, just instinctively. So I think that has some poetic aspect of the language of the Quran, and the way that it's recited is the musicality of it probably has some role in helping people memorize it. But I mean, that's something you'd
right.
know better.
Right. Well, and I mean, you know, you often hear people who are not necessarily from the region, not Muslim, and
yeah.
don't speak Arabic, that they'll say that they're touched by some of the calls to prayer, because there is a sort of a haunting sort of plaintive, a lamentation quality to the manner in which people are called to prayer. So I can certainly understand the musicality in terms of how it can touch you. So that's true. So now, having grown up in all those countries, did you grow up in a religious household, or how would you?
I had a Shia, sort of Shia Muslim family,
okay.
South Asian family. My parents were both born in India, and then they migrated to Pakistan. So, you know, they weren't really overtly religious, like very, very religious. They were conservative. You know, when we grew up, there were conservatives. Time went on and we grew older. I think us, me and my siblings probably had some role in sort of deconservatizing them to some right. extent, you know, when it came to that aspect. But it was a family that respected the religion. I mean, I had family members. My mother, like, on and off prayed 5 times a day. My dad used to do that too. There were times when they wouldn't, but for a lot of time they did. I certainly had I had cousins who were very religious as well. And I still actually get along with all of them very well. And we have very lively discussions, and they know exactly what I think. They're familiar with my work, and I'm still on good terms with them, which to me indicates that they are somewhat more progressive than a lot of the sort of the other families that I hear about.
And I think maybe you're being modest, because I think it also, I mean, yes, it speaks about them being open, but I think it also speaks about the manner in which you probably deliver and construct your messages, right? There is, I think, a way by which you could probably say the exact same thing, but if it was said in a different tone, or, you know, in not the style that you do it, I could imagine that the exact same content might be, they might respond to it very differently. And I mean, I think that's a credit to you. And I think that's why voices like yours are, you know, uniquely important in this battle of ideas, right?
Well, I appreciate that. I didn't think of that before. And I that may be part of it, but I also think, you know, I know we have friends, like my wife, Nalishpa, her friend, Sabine was recently, I mean, she was murdered in Karachi, and she was the most subtle person that there was. I don't know if you know, it was a big story. It was Sabine Mahmood was her name. She used to run a sort of an educational center where they discussed ideas very openly and so on. And so she was just murdered for speaking that way. And she was even more diplomatic than me. So in certain parts of the world, that isn't enough. I will kind of give my parents the credit that they're both university professors. Mm. So they were academics. They were very used to, they were both Western educated. My dad went to UBC. My mom was educated in Indiana. They were very open to the idea of questioning. They encouraged us to question, to doubt things. Of course, there were limits. I think that helped quite a bit. You know, just the fact that we could openly speak with them as well.
And so when was, you know, I mean, not that you could remember to the exact date, but when was it that you felt, you know what, I'm jumping off this train, I'm now an avowed non-believer? How was that trajectory? What led you to the position that you're at today?
I'll give you the, it's a short story,
right.
But I'll tell you, I amazingly started when I was 5 years old. So I had one of my aunts, like her daughter, my cousin, was my playmate. And I was five, she was three. And she had childhood leukemia. And this is back in the early 80s when, you know, there wasn't any, I mean, now childhood leukemia, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, is now very, it's treatable. It has rates of cure rates of over 90% in some cases. But at that time, it wasn't. So we were, when she was dying, and when, you know, everybody went into the room, you know, all the cousins, the aunts and uncles were all there. for her last moments. And I had a conversation with my father when I saw what was happening, because it's a child dying of cancer. And cancer doesn't discriminate. The same kind of pain that you would feel as an adult, you know, with bone cancer is the same thing that a child would feel. It doesn't discriminate. So, you know, she was clearly in a lot of pain, even though they'd given her lots of painkillers. My aunt and my mother were sitting at the side of her bed. They were crying. They had the Qurans open. They were praying and they were reading. I mean, to my recollection from what I remember. And I asked my dad, you know, I was like, what's happening? You know, because I mean, this is my, like, I used to play with her all the time as a kid. And my dad's like, well, you know, God is taking her back. You know, God is taking her back to him. So, you know, she can stay with him like she used to before. And then I asked him, I said, what about my mom and aunt? I was like, why are they praying so hard and crying so hard? What are they asking for? And he's like, they're begging God not to take her, or they're begging him to stop her pain. And, you know, that he basically told me things like that, that I think from his side, he was trying to make it,
of course,
nicer for me, the experience. But the first thing I thought, I mean, this is, I'm 5 years old. And I guess when you're younger, you have more clarity of thinking when it comes to that. I was thinking of a tug of war game. I'm like, on this one side, this is like my cousin. She's in there. She's like gasping in pain, right? And her mother and her aunt and all of us in the room are essentially, you know, it's a torturous situation. We don't want this to happen. And on the other hand, there's this, like, in my mind, as a five-year-old, there's like the sadistic asshole on the other end of the rope just pulling. And he's like, no, I'm going to take it. And we're begging him not to. But he ultimately has a power. He doesn't make it easy for her. He's not. It's not like he's going to make it painful and say, okay, she's three, I'll make it quicker. It's not even that. It's just that she has to go through all of the same stuff that everybody else has to go through. And it seemed completely pointless. And that was my first impression of God. And it's, I'm sure it's not the impression that my father wanted to give to me when he told me that. But that is the way that I took it. And since then, I didn't talk about it too much because, I mean, I was still a kid. But whenever I used to look around me, I used to think differently when people said something. Like if there was a plane crash and, you know, someone, they were like, there was a survivor, a single survivor, you know, two or three people survived, and they'd come on TV and they'd be like, well, you know, thank God, God blessed us, God saved us, we got, so I can't believe I survived this. Then everybody used to think, okay, that's great, you know, God saved him. And I used to think, I'm like, what the fuck are those other people doing? And I used to pick up on these things. But then, you know, later on, I had these two cousins, and one of them was very religious. I mean, he actually went to Iran, and you know, he became a proper Islamic scholar and everything like that. And I'm you know, he's a really good guy. And then his brother, who was completely non-religious. I mean, he was like blasphemous. I got introduced through him to Bertrand Russell.
Oh,
and yeah, he had the entire collection of Bertrand Russell books. So I had that, and they were living in the same house, and I lived with them for 3 years when I first moved to Lahore, like to Pakistan. I went to Lahore for a little while for the high school, and then I went to Karachi. And that's when I had a sort of an introduction to the more sort of liberal, you know, liberally interpretive, you know, version of Islam, because we used to have a lot of great discussions, and that's when I got really interested in it too. And around that time, I did try to, you know, go with the whole belief, that idea. And I still think that, you know, when it comes to the idea of God, the undefined God of Stephen Hawking and Spinoza, who, you know, the laws of the universe or what have you, I would probably say I'm agnostic. But when it comes to the God who writes books and impregnates virgins, you know, I'm almost certainly atheist.
Right. Now, so, incredible story. Thank you for sharing it. What a poignant story. Do you think that sort of medical context is what eventually led you to pursue a medical career? I mean, could you link the same story to both the start of your disbelief and the start of your interest in medicine? So in one incredible story, your two sort of passions as an adult were formed, or not really?
I think that that had a lot to do with it. I mean, it's interesting you hit on that, because that is something that I write about in my book as well.
Oh, okay.
That, you know, when we were talking about my parents and they encouraged me to question, so I didn't really come at this through a place of anger. I was sort of in a weird kind of, like my family was a bit of a sanctuary. It was fine. It was a safe space,
right,
which is not a great term nowadays.
Yes, yes.
In the old, you know, when it
yes.
was a safe space, it was a safe space. And outside of that, you know, it was Saudi Arabia,
right,
and the burqas and the beheadings and all the crazy shit. So there was a, so the questioning aspect is what brought me to, I guess, give up religion and
right.
to start like seriously questioning it, even living in that kind of society. But I always had an interest in death. Apart from my cousin, I'd seen my uncle, my dad's older brother, you know, when he died, I was about 11 years old. I'd seen a lot of sort of relatives die throughout my life when I was very young. So I ended up going into medicine.
Right.
And I was interested in like life sciences in general. I used to listen to death metal too. I was very, very into it. And, you know, just the lyrics about it. I used to read a lot about it. And then I ended up doing my residency in pathology to get boards. Well, to be eligible for the boards in pathology, to even take it, you have to have about, I think it's around 70 autopsies. So I did a lot of autopsies as a, during residency in pathology. And then, when I did my fellowship as well. So I've always been sort of, I guess it's something that I feared, but you know, when you fear something, like my personality is, I like going right up against it,
right,
and facing it and figuring it out, especially if that fear is because of curiosity. Sometimes, you know, we just fear things because we don't know enough about them. And the same thing with religion, death. I just wanted to get really close to them, question them, literally like cut them apart and see what's inside and how they tick. The exception is cockroaches. I'm scared of them, and I would never.
Well, I have a similar fear of mosquitoes, yeah. And I argue that mine is actually very adaptive, given that by far the greatest killer of humans by another species is by far the mosquito. And so when people sort of question that, why are you afraid of mosquitoes? I said, because it's completely adaptive. It doesn't really make sense to be afraid of bears and sharks from an evolutionary perspective, but to be afraid of mosquitoes makes sense.
Wouldn't you see that more widespread? I actually haven't heard of a lot of people. I wouldn't. Where I grew up, you wouldn't have survived.
Well, actually, I've been invited by several very good Indian friends to visit them in India, and my response usually is, my schema of India is that it's one big, gigantic mosquito. I'm not coming close to the damn place. So there you go. So there'll be no India for me. There'll be no Pakistan. Well, Pakistan, I won't go there for other reasons. But interestingly, about your being exposed to death, both in terms of your personal life and also in your professional life, one could have easily predicted another trajectory for you when it came to religion, right? Because I argue in one of my books that, you know, of course, the greatest benefit, quote, benefit that religion offers us is it allows us to swallow a pill of mortality, right? I mean, I mean, I don't need to tell you this, but if I've got a problem with my cholesterol, go see my physician, hit me with some Lipitor, LDL goes down, everything is good.
Yeah.
Well, I've got this problem with mortality because I'm aware of my death, and boy, if I swallow this religion pill, it all makes sense. So one could have easily predicted that somebody who is so immersed in death, who sees it a lot more than anybody else, could almost only become more religious, if only because it serves such a functional utilitarian purpose to your life, right?
But you know what? Before I actually worked in the field, I may have thought that too.
Right.
I can't remember. But one of the things I think that doing what I did does to a person,
right?
It's just language.
Yeah.
It actually makes you realize that it's not as scary as you think it is. I mean, the thing with autopsies, what's interesting is that, you know, as in Buffalo, New York, you know, there's the hospital there, and they would stay in the morgue sometimes late hours to go and, you know, sort of section our specimens, the organs, and section them for the microscopic review and so on later on. So sometimes I'd be working there late at night, like maybe 7 or 8, and I'd be in a morgue, and I know that the morgue is entirely full of, there's a room, there's drawers, and there's like sort of, there's dead bodies everywhere in the refrigerator. And the first couple of times I went there, it scared me. It doesn't matter how rational you are. It's something that it's just creepy. And then after a while, I actually started finding it a very peaceful place to work because dead people don't make a lot of noise.
they don't medically sue you.
They don't sue you. That's the thing. Like, you know, you're not going to have a lot of malpractice lawsuits. You know, you can experiment. And the other thing is, you know, I just started thinking, like, you go in and the fear is that one of these dead people is going to come alive like a zombie and come get whatever the, I don't know what people's fears are, but that may be one of them. But most of these people, like when I autopsied, I knew that they were incredibly sick. They were too weak to get up even when they were alive. So, you know, to expect them to do that would be strange. And the other thing is, I also learned during residency, and for anybody out there who's done residency, living people are a lot scarier than dead people. They're terrible that way.
Right.
So I did, but on a serious note, yes, like, you know, I would see them and they'd always show up. They'd be on the stretcher. They'd be naked. They'd have toe tags. You couldn't tell if they were rich or poor. You couldn't tell if they were a billionaire or how much money they had in their account, they're educated or not, whether they died with their family members around them, whether they died completely alone on the street, whether anybody did, you didn't know that until you read their chart.
Death is the great equalizer.
It is the great equalizer. And I think that's one of the things that it's weird, but in a peaceful kind of way, you know, you start thinking like these people look very peaceful. Like they don't have a care in the world. They're not even aware that they ever lived. And that's something that's very unsettling to us. But at the same time, there's something sort of, I think a lot of people sometimes when they commit suicide, you know, they say that they become very cheerful a few days before they do it, and they go and they meet all their friends and family and really spend time with them and so on. I've read stories like that, and I think that may be because they've thought of it. They finally have a solution to everything that's plaguing them.
Right.
They're like, oh, okay, now it's going to be over. In 3 days, it's going to be over. I'm not going to be going through any of this.
Right.
So they don't have to worry about anything. And I think that this experience made me sort of understand that mindset in a way.
So as a medical doctor, and given what you just said, could we assume then that you would be somebody who would be a supporter of legalized euthanasia? And of course,
I absolutely say yes.
Yes, okay.
I think that, legalized euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, we should have the right to choose the way we live, and we should have the right to choose the way we die.
Right.
And I think we definitely need more. This whole idea about, you know, that, you know, life being sacred and forcing people to stay alive, I actually think it's inhuman. You know, when they say do no harm,
right?
And they use that as an argument against euthanasia. I think that's probably an argument for it.
Right. Well, interesting. So are you still practicing medicine, or are you now strictly an author and a speaker, or are you still immersed
in the... No, I switched out of it.
Oh, so you've got nothing to do with medicine anymore.
I don't. Well, I do kind of. I still work in the capacity of an MD. I work in medical communications. That's sort of my day job. So I do. It's a vast field. I mean, start talking about that, we'll go on for a while.
Right.
Get distracted, but it's a great field. I enjoy it a lot. And the best thing about it is that it's very creative, and it allows me to write. So one of the reasons I made the switch is because I wanted to do more writing.
Right.
When you have a full-time medical career, it's very, very difficult to, I guess not only time-wise, you know, make time for that, but also be in that kind of headspace.
Yes.
You know, the thing with, I would say the difference between being a scientist and being a physician is that one is really science, and the other is more of a public service. Like, you know, the scientists can, they can experiment. They're supposed to experiment. They can go off on tangents. I mean, like, oh, I wonder what would happen if I mix this with this.
Yes.
But if you're doing cardiac surgery and you're like, oh, I wonder what would happen if I, you're not going to be a doctor for much longer.
Well, incidentally, the the pursuit of these intellectual landscapes, sort of to pick up on your point, is exactly what makes me wake up every morning feeling incredibly invigorated and happy. I mean, yes, of course, I'm also thankful that I've got health and that I've got a great family. But in terms of sort of my daily professional pursuits, you know, every day I wake up knowing that there could be the next tweet that could be exciting. Some study that I'm running next with some of my graduate students is exciting. I'm working on a book, a grant application. I'm reading something. So in other words, it's endless for me. I'm eating, and I truly am a kid in a candy store that has infinite candies to eat.
No, I know. I did. I went to grad school. I actually also have a master's in biochemistry, where I did pretty much a molecular biology product project. And one of the things that I loved about it was that I knew that I was working on something that nobody else had worked on before.
Exactly.
Like, I knew that whatever I was going to find at the end of this project was going to be something, or even on a daily basis, some of the things I was going to find are things that everything was new. Like nobody has found this before. That's why I'm doing it. And that is something that's really, really exhilarating. I mean, pathology was a lot of fun. The diagnosis, and like it was like solving puzzles all day. It's like HouseMD, but at a microscope.
Right.
So I enjoyed it. The only thing is I really, really wanted to. My writing was taking off.
Right.
I felt that I had a lot more to say. And I eventually had to make the decision. I think I made it about 4 years ago, where I thought, I was like, okay, there's this other career that where I can do medicine. I can marry it with the whole writing aspect.
Right.
But I also, and you know, pathology, the lifestyle is nice, but even in this case, like, you know, I can have some time on weekends and evenings to sort of stay in that creative headspace all the time.
So maybe a good segue to our to your writing. Can you tell us a bit? I know that you're coming out with a book soon, a very exciting book. Is it still called The Atheist Muslim?
It is. Yeah, my my publishers really like the Atheist Muslim, the title. Especially, I think it baffles everybody in the beginning.
Right.
But the book is really about ideology versus identity.
Right.
You know, how to separate the two, how to recognize them as separate things, and so on. And that's really where the title becomes very relevant. So they really like it. The subtitle's still under discussion.
Right.
But we're moving ahead with it.
So from a strict doctrinal perspective, though,
yeah,
would it be correct in saying it is impossible to put those two words together? True?
From a strict doctrinal?
Yes, of course. Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's impossible to put them together. A lot of this was the way that the title came about is, or the way that the phrase "the atheist Muslim" came about is essentially it was a joke.
Right.
And it was, and I've told the story before. I had a friend who calls herself a feminist Muslim.
Yes.
And I always found that, I found that it's got a little bit of a contradiction. I know like some great women, Muslims who are feminists, like Asra Nomani.
Yes.
And like Mona Al-Tahawi and so on. But this is, I just told her, I'm like, isn't that a contradiction? Right. I'm like, you know, what about all these verses in the Quran and so on?
No, you're just misunderstanding them because you don't speak Arabic well.
Yeah, I know, of course. Yeah, because I don't. So I told her, I'm like, isn't that like being a meat eating vegetarian,
right?
You know, or some other sort of a contradictory term. And she said, no, you know, we all pick and choose,
right?
And she was right. I mean, the moderate Muslims obviously pick and choose. Even the sort of rabid Islamists a lot of times pick and choose as well. Right. So I just thought, you know, that you ask someone who is a hijabi, and they will tell you that the person, woman wearing the burqa is not Islamic.
Yeah, yeah.
And the person who doesn't wear hijab and will be like, well, no, the hijab isn't really necessary. And then the sort of the feminist Muslim woman who says not only that Islam is that she could be a feminist Muslim, but Islam actually brought those rights before
Western
society or you know, modern civilization anywhere in the world. It doesn't even have to be Western. So when they, there's different levels, and they all think that the other one isn't really.
Well, I did a clip on this. So the no true Scotsman fallacy as applied to Islam. And,
yes.
And have you seen? I'm not sure if you've seen the clip. But basically, for those who might not, I'll just kind of summarize it. So in various conversations I've had with people, both privately or publicly, about some issue, so I will cite some, definitive Islamic source. So I'll mention Yusuf al-Qaradawi, right? Who's the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, who's perhaps the most known. Not a real Muslim. Bullshitter. Doesn't know. But your friend Ahmed, who drinks alcohol and is doing his PhD in women's studies at Carleton University, who's liberal, that's real Islam. So it's
yeah, and it's that's a problem, and that's something that we're gonna have to talk about. There's no authority figure.
Yes.
So everybody has an idea of who is a true Muslim and who isn't, and like you said, the no true Scotsman's family. And I write about that a lot in my book as well.
Okay.
And it's also one of the reasons that I've actually decided to focus in my book just purely on the Quran as a definition of Islam. And not even going to the Hadith or the Sirah or anything like that. The Sirah is the biography of the Prophet and so on. And it comes down to actually something that you said, and I've been saying since I was very, very young, and I loved it when you said it, is when you talked about Jews and pork.
Yes.
Right? The idea that if Jews, like just a lot of Jews eat bacon, right. Or supposing most Jews, supposing we do a study and find out that 80% of Jews sometimes eat bacon.
Yes.
Does that mean that Judaism is suddenly okay with bacon?
Yes.
No, it doesn't, because Jews are not defined by, or Judaism itself is not defined by the actions of its adherents, assuming they're all religious Jews. I know most of you guys.
No, I'll tell you why I'm smiling in a second, but go on.
Yeah. And it's the same thing with the Muslims. Like, I know a lot of Muslims who have premarital, relationships with, like they have premarital sex or... they do a lot of things that you're not supposed to do, that
yes.
Islam is not okay with. They still do. And yes. You can't say that their actions are Islamic just because they do them.
Right.
So a religion is defined by the contents of its canonical texts
yes.
or text, not by the actions of its adherents. And the Quran is the one thing that is exactly the same and consistent and equally valued across every faction, every sect
yes.
of Muslims, Shia, Sunni, Ismaili, even like everybody. We don't have a whole lot of Mu'tazilites
right.
left. That may have been a bit of an exception, but
right.
yeah.
Alawites?
Yeah.
Yeah. Alawites. But the reason why I was smiling is because the prophet, whose name I don't wish to take in vain, Majid Nawaz, chastised me, educated me, scolded me for using the example with the Jews and pork. And so I was smiling because he may come after you for also being dim-witted with that example.
Yeah, so this is one place where we're probably going to disagree a little bit.
Yes.
And I disagree with Majid on a lot of this
yes.
stuff too. And he will tell you that he disagrees with me too. So, but Majid is a friend. I met him when he came to Toronto and, we correspond regularly and so on. And, he's also been in his last book with Sam Harris and
yes.
So on. Actually helped consult on some of that stuff for them too with Sam. So there's I do understand where you're coming from, and I probably do agree with you in the sense of when it comes to the whole Jews and pork
yes,
idea.
Yes.
But I think that what he's doing also has a place.
Yes.
Right? And that's a conversation we can definitely have.
Can I interject?
So, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's my take on it. I think that the objective that he has is laudable. Mm-hmm. And in the clips that I've produced where I critique some of his work, I make sure to be very clear in
yes,
complimenting
yeah.
him about many of the things that he does. I think the problem is, and this is not a, it's not a, the point is not to criticize a person, but it actually speaks about openness to debate,
right?
And so I disagree with his attempts at reformation. There are very, very clear ways by which he says things that are absolutely incorrect when it comes to interpretation. There's no
mm-hmm.
question about it. His approach has been profoundly dismissive and hostile. It's as though I were a sycophant schoolgirl who's trying to get his autograph. My life is going to go on and I'm going to love again whether I chat with Majid or not. My point was, you're doing fantastic stuff, but you're the guy who is calling for people to discuss ideas. So I agree with 95% of the wonderful things you're doing, but here are some things where we might be able to chat and see if we could come to some sort of agreement or maybe continue to disagree. And his position was, I've already had that conversation. I've already written the final inerrant book that doesn't require changing, so go away. And I thought that that's regrettable, because that's not really the way that one should be engaging one another, especially when I repeatedly publicly state that, look, this guy is the type of voice that we need. So, but certainly there is room for us to disagree.
I think, and this is going to be like, it's a tough thing for me, because I love Majid.
So maybe we don't talk about him. Let's talk about Reformation. How about we do that?
I was actually going to go. I mean, and I understand. I'm not saying that what you're saying doesn't have any basis, but you know, I don't know what
of course
I said either. But what I'm saying about his ideas, and I think that one thing that he's doing, even though I disagree with him, and I think anybody, I mean, if you're an atheist, and if you actually think that the Quran has a lot of problems in it, you're going to disagree with him right from the get-go, and he knows that. And he knows that with Sam Harris, obviously, they have profound disagreements on a lot of things, and I would too, right, with Majid. But I think that one thing that he does is there's a lot of Western Muslims, a lot of like younger people, they're trying to find a new way to go about these things. And I think that what he's doing, and in my book I talk about this, I think that sometimes more than the conversation itself, what's important is to set the stage for a conversation.
Right.
Like, I know that with Ayaan Hirsi Ali, you know, she comes out and, you know, she'll say, okay, these are the five steps. These are the things all you Muslims have to do to reform your faith. And she'll say that, and a lot of times it'll go on deaf ears. And it's not because what she's saying is wrong. I mean, it's actually completely true. And her book is great. The only problem is that a lot of people are not going to be receptive to it, because they already look at her as a polarizing figure, and they're not used to that kind of open conversation. They will take an attack on their religion as a personal attack on them. And this is why, you know, which is the central theme of my book, is that to be able to set the stage for that conversation, you know, that's where you learn, and you tell people that, you know, just because, you know, you believe this stuff doesn't mean that these are your beliefs. Right. And these are things that you were taught as a kid. They're part of your identity. Like that hijab you wear on your head. I mean, you choose to wear it because you want to stick to, like, this is who I am. Why are you attacking who I am? And we've conflated ideology and identity,
right,
made them seem like the same thing. So the only way that you can actually have the first step to a reformation is if you have I can't believe I'm saying this phrase twice in this conversation, a safe space. And in the context of Muslims, yes, right, it is absolutely essential.
So, and I think, you know, I'd like to give him the benefit of the doubt. And so what you're basically saying is that there's a pragmatism to his approach that is necessary to start the conversation.
Well, I'm also saying one other thing. I'm saying that there's, when I was in Pakistan, or when I was in Saudi Arabia, they used to shut you up using blasphemy laws, yes, right? So you couldn't say anything, was the blasphemy laws. Over here, what they do is they try to shame you into silence.
Yes.
You're a bigot. You're a racist. You're an Islamophobe. And nobody wants to hear those things. Nobody wants to be accused of them. So what that does is it shuts people off. It makes younger people who are questioning, like especially, you know, the younger generation,
yes,
that is questioning, is coming out, seeing all these things, exposed to all these different views, and trying to figure out where they want to go. They're not able to properly question anything because they're immediately shut down by all this stuff. So I think one of the most important things that Majid is doing is that he's providing a space for that kind of questioning.
Yes.
Because to have reformation, first thing you have to do is get rid of the idea of infallibility.
Yes.
Infallible Quran, prophet, you know, being the infallible example for all time, for everybody to emulate. So what he's doing is that he's saying that I am a Muslim. He's coming from the point of view of a Muslim,
yes,
who is challenging infallibility. So he's actually opening up that message and setting a stage,
yes,
for people, and especially for younger people. You know, when it comes to people, a lot of And my friends, a lot of them say, like, what, you're trying to convert me? Why are you trying to convert me to your thing? I'm like, I'm not converting you. I'm talking to all the kids who message me. And I get hundreds of messages from them. And some of them are actually the kids of my cousins and my friends. And they're like, don't tell dad, don't tell mom this. But, you know, I agree with you. Can you tell me more about this? Or can you tell me more about that? That's who I have in mind when I'm writing this book.
Right.
And I think that that's kind of what Majid also wants to do. He just wants to know, he wants people to know that if they're questioning, there are different ways. You know, you have the Ali Rizvi and the Gad Saad who, you know, have a certain point of view. You also have people like him where you don't have to like immediately let go of everything immediately.
Right.
You know, there is a way that you can live. So I think that there is a space for all of that. From a doctrinal perspective and an academic university, if we're going to have a debate, I would have the same disagreements with Majid that you have with him, right?
So do you see a way where you could actually theologically implement a reformation that would take all of the problematic passages, not only in the Quran, of course, but in the other accompanying holy texts, whether it be the Sirah or the Hadith, and find a way in not one swoop, but not by sitting and playing tortuous gymnastics with each of the sentences that are problematic and talking about Arabic philology, to kill means to caress and to...
I don't think that works.
So you don't think that. So how do you actually then reform? If somebody then goes to the holy books and tries to read them, how do you get them to extract? Now, without getting into the Reza Aslan, everybody interprets anything any way they want, and
Rorschach test,
and jump into the postmodernist bath. So forgetting about postmodernism for a second, I mean, words have meaning. If it says kill, 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 there is no way for me to interpret that as love, love, love. Right. And so what is the way to reform? How do we do it? Like the actual getting our hands dirty, how do we do it?
The first step to it, I'll tell you, like reformation, just by definition, and infallibility by definition, do not go together. They can never go together. So first step to reformation is to question the idea of infallibility.
Right.
Okay, so I think of it in several steps. I mean, you have the idea of, you know, questioning infallibility. All right, and then you have reformation, or to some extent, and then after that, you know, you have questioning infallibility. Then you have secularism, the separation of religion and state, and then after that, that's a space in secularism. You can actually talk about things finally,
right?
And once you do that, then you can move to a reformation, and that is what's happened with, you know, with Christians and Jews and a lot of other, you know, religious groups is. Most of them, they don't. I mean, as you know, with Judaism, right? As far as I know, I mean, originally the Torah was the book revealed to Moses by God at the tabernacle and on Mount Sinai, right?
Yeah.
Nobody really, really thinks that anymore. Right. The Bible, nobody really thinks that that's the word of God in Christianity either. I mean, there are 30% of people in the U.S. that do still, but apart from that, most people don't. So, excuse me. So the now they think of this divinely inspired, right? But that allows them. That's a little bit of a go ahead. It's a green light, divinely inspired. Hey, it's divinely inspired. It becomes like the Hadith, right? And the Hadith, the most Western Muslims, most progressive Muslims, don't really take the Hadith seriously. They're like, well, I don't know if that's authentic, and they'll just dismiss it. So the thing with the Quran is to talk about the history of it, to challenge the infallibility of it, right? And get to a point where people can actually read it like they read the Bible or the Torah. Like in the Old Testament, I was telling somebody this today, in Deuteronomy 20, right? Have you read it? And especially passage
10. Yeah, I don't remember what 20 is, but of course I know.
Oh, okay, Torah. So Deuteronomy 20:10. Yes. Okay, and actually, if you can give me a second, do you mind if I read it out?
Yeah, of course, go ahead.
It actually tells you, it's very...
Now, but you're not reading in Aramaic, so therefore it's a mistranslation, and I don't trust you.
Yeah, I know, the interpretation. But that's something I think, fortunately, most Jews have gotten past. Because, I mean, it's already Deuteronomy and not, what was the Hebrew Bible name? Was it Devarim? How do you know? I don't know if you know.
Davarim.
It's the same book.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we go. Deuteronomy 20 verses or passages or lines 10 to 18. It's right here.
Right.
When you march up, and tell me which militant group this reminds you of. When you march up to attack a city, make its people an offer of peace. If they accept and open their gates, all the people in it shall be subject to forced labor and shall work for you. If they refuse to make peace and they engage you in battle, lay siege to that city. When the Lord your God delivers it into your hand, put the sword to all the men in it. As for the women, the children, the livestock, and everything else in the city, you may take these as plunder for yourself.
Yes.
Just think about terrorist groups you have in mind.
I can't think of any.
And you may use the plunder the Lord your God gives you from your enemies. This is how you are to treat all the cities that are at a distance from you and do not belong to the nations nearby. Right? However, in the cities of the nations the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, do not leave alive anything that breathes. Completely destroy them. And then has a whole bunch of tribes that will give it away.
I'm guessing this is from Richard Dawkins' book, The New Atheist Manifesto. I mean,
this is what Anders Breivik was reading. Don't you? Or the guy, the Chapel Hill
guy. Yes.
So, I mean, this is something that is in the Old Testament.
Yes.
In the Torah and the Christian Bible. I mean, those who take the Old Testament seriously in Christianity. And nobody takes it seriously today. No one does.
But do you not think that there is something in the doctrines of the three Abrahamic religions that might make some of them less susceptible? So do you think it's only the infallibility clause that makes Islam uniquely different from the other two? Is that really the gist of it?
I think right now, yes. Okay. I think that really is. Because when it comes to the books, you know, the book of you guys, when I say you guys, I always wanted to say that.
just say it, the chosen people.
I know, the chosen people. So yeah, the difference between generally the book of the Jews and the book of the Muslims, they're quite similar. I always think, you know, there's two prophets, both of them, their nicknames are Mo, you know, Moses and Muhammad.
Right.
You got Shalom and Salam.
Yes.
You know, nobody has no foreskin for miles.
Yes.
And, you know, the pork thing, they're anti-pork, which doesn't make sense because, you know, Abraham, right? You have Muhammad, you know, had also
Ham. Yes. Okay. He said it, people. Send him the hate mail. Yeah, I've got nothing to do with this.
Well, even Jesus, if you read it backwards, it's sausage in a way. Oh, it sounds a lot like sausage.
Oh, boy. Equal opportunity.
I'm telling you, it's just, it's everywhere. So despite all that, there's a lot of hostility towards pork. So there's a lot of things that are common. I would say that the New Testament is a bit of an improvement. It seems like a little bit of Buddha influence got in there. So, you know, there's the forgiveness and the love and the peace and turning the other cheek. But the horrific violence only happens after you die.
Right.
And it's only used as a tool to manipulate you while you're alive. Right? Okay.
So that's Can I suggest maybe another difference and you'll comment on it? I think, for example, if you look at Judaism, it's not a proselytizing religion. If anything, it's the exact opposite, right? So there are 13 million Jews in the world. And there is a reason for that. That's because if you want to join the club, if you want to join the football team called the Jews, you have to jump through a million hoops. And the mechanism, And the mechanism to become a Jew is one that actually is very, very difficult. The idea being that you want to make sure that the person who is converting to Judaism in a doctrinal sense is really one who spiritually wants to do this. And therefore, from a strict marketing perspective, right. If we're selling products where products are religions, Judaism is really sucky at marketing. It's horrible, right? 13 million adherents in several thousand years.
Christianity is amazing, though.
Christianity is amazing, but so is Islam. In that it is an expansionist religion. There are doctrines, and one can debate what is meant, but I think most sane people agree that there is the element of the world will be united in peace when everybody is under the flag of Allah, and that causes problems. So I don't think it's only a question of the infallibility. It's a question of the expansionism, the goals of expansionism that are inherent in some religions and not inherent at all in others. And until you're able to quell that, somehow expunge that from some of the central features of the religion, you're always going to have problems, correct?
No, yeah, I think that that's a good point. I think that's true. But I really think that the infallibility aspect is the umbrella when it comes to it, because the whole idea of jihad and expansionism and things, that's the most controversial parts of Islam are followed because they're in the Quran. And one, the biggest problem I think is that, well, I'll just give you a bit of a backstory. When I was younger, and I've written about this before, when I grew up before the internet, you know, we couldn't look up verses and scriptures and things like that, you know, right in the middle of a Facebook argument. It's like, oh yeah, well, let me find it, and keyword searches and so on. So we had the Quran, and it was at the highest place in our house. It was a tall bookshelf in the living room. The Quran was right up top. You had to do wudu, or this ablution, you know, washing process before you even touch it or recite it. If you're a woman, you're menstruating, you can't read it, touch it, nothing. And if you do open it up, then the largest populations in the Muslim world, which are in Indonesia, India, Pakistan, Iran, Turkey,
Malaysia,
Bangladesh, Malaysia. Yeah, so all of these countries, they don't speak Arabic. They're all non-Arabic speaking. They all had the Qurans in their house. They all read it and recited it. They didn't know anything about what it meant, which is a little ironic because the first revelation was apparently Iqra, which is read. So nobody would read it unless you actually got a translation. If you got a translation, now you know that you'd given 10 different translations and be like, they're all wrong. Right. But at that point, you could only really afford to buy one or two, you know, and they would always be contentious. There was never a good translation. So it was impossible for anybody to know it was in the Quran. The only thing we went by was what our parents told us.
Right.
Our parents went by what their parents told them. And what their parents told them was that this is a peaceful religion. Take care of your kids. You know, be good to people around you. Feed the needy. You know, that and teach that to your kids. So we grow up, you know, thinking this is a religion, and a lot of kids, and suddenly the internet shows up. And now, you know, you're looking for these things. Your parents have raised you thinking that, you know, Islam is a religion of peace. That's what it says in the Quran, and the Quran is a word of God. You got to follow it no matter what. So now you look up the Quran. Your parents, by the way, haven't read the Quran at all. They don't know. They had the same limitations.
Exactly.
Now, you know, you're online. There's this new thing called the internet. And some guy tells you, he's like, yo, you know you can have sex with your slave girls in the Quran?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, that's impossible. Because my dad never, you know.
He never said that.
Slave. We never had any slave girls. He never.
Right.
He would have been doing it all the time. Like, I'm kidding. He's a great man. But so you go online and you look up slave girls Quran. You type that into Google or Yahoo or whatever you had at that time. And suddenly all these verses show up. You read more. You see more things. And whatever translation you want, it's all listed right there on one website. Whatever language you want is right there. And now you're looking at this, and you're thinking, you grew up thinking that this is a word of God. This is what you got to follow. So when they say that things have become more polarized now, I think that's the fork. That's a turning point.
Right.
You look at that, and either you become like me, you're like, okay, what my parents told me was, you know, that was wrong. You know, my mom also told me I'd look better with, you know, shorter hair, and that was bullshit. So this is probably bullshit too. And, you know, on the other hand, you would look at this and be like, well, you know, my parents are wrong. They told me all the stuff that was in here that isn't, but this is the word of God, and I'm going to, you know, take it to the next level. And then you join, you become a fundamentalist.
Right.
So there is, I mean, that's a very simplified version, admittedly, of what happens. But I think that that is sort of at least an outline of what is going on now. There's much more awareness of what's in the book. There's much more money behind fundamentalist ideologies. There's so many different factors. There is the factor of the every time there's the Taliban, let's go bomb them.
Right.
Okay, there's the Saddam, let's go bomb him. ISIS is there, let's go bomb them. And all the ISIS folks that are really causing all the trouble are the ones that were born and raised in France and Belgium and England and so on. And now, you know, we're trying to bomb away this ideology over and over again. And then terrorism 4.0 is going to show up.
Right.
And all the wars of the past cumulatively are going to be their recruiting tools.
Right.
And it's just an endless cycle. And I think that the only way to fight it is to fight the ideology, fight the very roots of it, the very things about it that are the most fundamental and the most sacred. Tell people how the Quran was compiled, that it wasn't even put together until the caliph's reign, Uthman. Feel free to talk about all the different interpretations, how it's seen. Refer people to websites and just tell them that it's not like these are, and just push forth the idea that this is not an infallible book. Like there's the God that apparently, if you believe in God, you think that the Big Bang and the evolution and, you know, tectonic plate shifts and all these amazing things that we see in the universe are all due to him. So how do you match that up with a guy who doesn't want you to eat pork?
Right.
There are many, and this is kind of what I talked to people about when I was growing up in Saudi Arabia, because over there I couldn't really tell them there's no God. But I would make some of these sort of other tangential arguments, and I actually found them to be a lot more effective.
Right.
So,
incidentally, one of the things that really, that I'm committed to, of course I've got my scientific career, that could certainly keep me busy 18 hours a day. But on in the parallel track as a public intellectual, I'm interested in tackling bad ideas. Now, in this context, we're talking about potentially bad ideas that stem from religious texts. But of course, we could talk about bad ideas stemming from all sorts of non-religious contexts, right? It could be the social justice warrior types, right? Who are,
right,
in many cases, not in the least bit religious. It could be radical feminism, right? It could be bad thinking in that people commit cognitive errors in their reasoning strategies, right? And so I'm interested. So if you look at a lot of my interventions, whether it be I'm just having a random blow with somebody on Twitter, or if I produce a YouTube clip, I'm very interested in tackling bad ideas. Now, it's part of my personality that I'm sort of this dogged pursuer of truth. I get literally offended by stupidity. And I don't mean that in an arrogant sense that, I'm the big professor who's supposed to educate everyone. But, if you arm people with the tools to think properly. When they make, for example, statistical errors in reasoning, right? I mean, I'll give you a simple example that comes from, say, my work in evolutionary psychology. So if you propose to somebody an evolutionary mechanism that should operate at the population level, then somebody will come up with a singular example that's supposed to falsify the phenomena at the population level. So let me give you an example. If I say, men are physically bigger than women, there is sexual dimorphism in the human species, then somebody will raise their hand and say, but my aunt Joanne is taller than my uncle Bob. Oh shit, Darwin is dead. What are we going to do, right? Well, that's because they're committing that particular cognitive error. And so in that sense, I view my contributions to the discussion regarding religion as part of a greater drive to try to equip people, or at least to contribute to the conversation of how to think properly. Because once you get people to think properly, then hopefully they could navigate through some of these discussions in a more optimal manner.
I think that, teaching people how to think, the critical thinking aspect, I think that's also very important as well. I mean, that's actually essential.
Exactly.
I don't mean just very important. That goes right along with the whole idea of infallibility. I mean, it's, if you look at something that's infallible by definition, you're obviously not looking at it critically. The critical thinking thing doesn't apply. But if you teach people to think that way all the time, and it's natural. I think that's natural in us. It's natural in human beings. And when I told you the story about when I was 5 years old, when I was hearing this narrative from my dad, and my mind, unconsciously, I didn't even know what skepticism was or what critical thinking meant, but I was naturally going down that road in my mind. I was questioning. I was like, this doesn't make sense. And I remember the tug of war analogy, because we used to play tug of war, we used to do all the time. And that is the first thing that came into my mind.
Right.
So, the gods on one side pulling, and then we're on the other side saying, don't take them away. And I think that even at that level, it's something that's so natural in kids and human beings to have those critical thinking faculties. All you really have to do is facilitate them and encourage them to come out. And this is another thing that's so sinister about religious indoctrination, just religion in general, is that it quashes that sort of that natural.
But by definition, that we have. I mean, you have to do that to that belief, right? So
yeah.
It's a first step. I mean, suspend your reason and jump into the belief pool. That's what makes you religious, right?
Right, exactly. It's
now it's, I wanted to. So I don't know if you saw my latest clip I put up earlier today. I created an analogy between. So I said basically that if you openly dislike broccoli, you're homophobic. And I use that as an analogy. By the way,
I need to see it now.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's a good one. It's getting a lot of views. How are we doing on time? Do you have it? Do we have to stop?
I haven't been keeping time, but
because I could go on.
It's right. Yeah, it's around 9:30. I think
it's 9:30. Yeah, so we're okay. We could go on for a bit more.
Yeah.
Okay, no problem. So in this particular analogy, and I often use that as a strategy. It's something that I innately, I guess, have the ability to do, but it really cuts through. I mean, as a medical doctor, I could use this term. It's like a scalpel that cuts through the bullshit. And the example that I was trying to use there is, you know, when people constantly say that if you criticize religion, you are a racist and bigot. I said that the logical structure of that if-then argument is identical to if you dislike broccoli, then you are homophobic. Those two, you cannot be racist against a set of ideas in the same way that you can't say the statement, you know, I really like this car, it has a good sense of humor. You cannot use that descriptor that is human quality on an inanimate object. And then I get people who write to me and say, my goodness, I never thought of it putting it that way. So I think there is a way by which you can offer people analogies that really brings out the fallacy in their original positions. And I think that's really important to do, because the kind of regressive mindset has erected this edifice of impenetrable bullshit that unless you find the right scalpel to cut through it, it's just, I mean, and I'm sure you've had a million of these conversations. I mean, I see sometimes on your Facebook, right? I mean, so what are some of the strategies that you use? I give you one strategy, analytical thinking. What are some of the strategies you use to cut through?
Well, you know, the thing is we actually think very alike when it comes to this. I think that when it comes to, I use a lot of analogies,
right?
Like, you know, but the analogy that it's like the Jews and pork and Judaism and pork thing, that's an analogy that I've used since I was very young.
Nice.
So it was, and I'm surprised that more people haven't, you know, that they don't pick up on it. Another one that I've used in terms of like my main thing right now, the crux of my book is the separation of criticizing ideas and people and how to differentiate between those two. And the reason for that really quick is because, you know, when I first came here, I saw on the right, you know, people, there was this narrative that, you know, these there's the jihad going on, people beheading people. So all Muslims are terrorists and we should not allow them into the country. That is one. And then on the left, there was this idea that, well, you know, Muslims have a right to believe in whatever they want to. So, you know, that we should be tolerant towards them. And that's why, you know, we should be okay with everything it says in the Quran, because that's part of their faith. And both of them are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
They're both conflating the ideology with the identity, right? They're the Islamic ideology with the Muslim identity. And to people like myself, I mean, I think that I grew up with, and I grew up around, grew up in that part of the world, and I think you may have been exposed to this a lot too, is that people don't actually conflate those two things that much. They don't. You know, they... and that's just something that I didn't see here a lot. It was very, very polarized and very binary. So one of the analogies that I like to use that I think cuts to the heart of it is of smoking, because, you know, I used to be a smoker, and I probably will be at some point. I've quit many times. They're so good, cigarettes. Anyway.
I've never smoked a single cigarette in my entire life. Not one.
Really?
Not one. Not a single one.
Don't start.
Well, at my age, I think you probably may or may not know this. That if you don't start by age 19, you almost have zero chance of starting. That's why cigarette companies are particularly keen on targeting
their young. Yeah. So, yeah, in any case, I feel like a complete idiot now, because I actually started when I was 22.
Oh, boy. You're an outlier.
No,
you're
a freak. It was because of Casino, the Robert De Niro movie.
Have you seen it? Yeah, of course I've seen it.
There is a scene in it where he comes out and he's wearing a pink bathrobe and he's in the kitchen. He's just smoking a cigarette. And the entire time, I never smoked a cigarette. And I saw that movie. It was, I think I was 21 or 20. I think I was probably 21, 22 when I saw the movie. And a year later, I was a regular smoker because he just looked so badass having that cigarette. De Niro, yeah, everybody wanted to be De Niro.
Yes, you know? Yes.
But yeah, back to that. My, like, the analogy was that smoking, if I say that smoking is a filthy habit, it doesn't mean I think all smokers are filthy people.
Exactly right.
In fact, some of the coolest people that I've met, and the most like interesting people I've met are cigarette smokers.
Right.
And you know, I can go around. I can say that smoking is terrible for you. It smells. It's disgusting. You know, it kills you really soon. It's super expensive. It's a waste of money. You know, it causes harm to your kids. And you know, with the secondhand smoke, and I can say all those things. That doesn't mean at all that I'm saying the smoker wants to intentionally damage his kids, or the smoker smells disgusting, or he smells filthy, or he's just that you know, he's making a bad decision. And none of that.
Or he's not a kind person and a caring person and a peaceful person. It has nothing to do with that. Exactly.
Has nothing to do with it. And of course, you can really parse it, and you can say that, okay, smoking is just a habit. It doesn't come with a set of beliefs and so on. But that's true. But the overall analogy is that, you know, there are things that people, like, there are beliefs that people have or think they have that are not really their own. I mean, right. They're things that they have been taught to believe.
Right.
And when they get offended about it, and we've all seen this. You know, you talk to a person and they're like, why are you attacking Islam? Islam's my identity. It's my religion. Blah, blah, blah. Why are you doing it? And then you show him one verse in the Quran. He's like, no, that can't be right.
Yeah, this is
an interpretation issue. Show him something else. No, this was actually meant for the four Sahaba of the Prophet who were sitting at breakfast on July 11th, 610, you know, some specific moment.
For those who don't know that word, that means friend. I just want to translate what you just said, yes.
Yeah.
The four friends of Muhammad, yes.
Sahaba, yes, yeah. So that means friend. So there's, I lost my train of thought for a second. They basically give you that context. And you realize very soon that they are not familiar with the stuff at all.
Yeah.
You know, I've had people come up to me and quote 532, the verse that says that you kill one human being, and it says if you've killed all of humanity. And there are memes about it. All of the internet shows up after every terrorist event. And all I do is I just ask, I'm like, can you guys just get the very next verse and also post it here? Because the very next verse says that if someone opposes you or someone wages war against you, which is they think that everybody's waging war against them, then you crucify them and behead them. Like, you kill them and crucify and cut their limbs off from, like, opposite ends or something like that. And the same thing with the religion of no compulsion in religion.
Yes.
That's Surah 2, verse 256, if anybody wants to look it up.
Yes.
It says, let there be no compulsion in religion. And then the very next verse, 2257, says that, except for the disbelievers, because they're going to be in Taghut and going to have a terrible, terrible fate.
Right.
And it completely contradicts it. So, and most people don't know this. And when you see that, that's when you realize that what they're really defending is their sense of identity.
Exactly.
You know, they know nothing. They know very, very little. About, I think Sam Harris's quote that, you know, he said moderation is a combination of, you know, I can't even do that. This is like a Rick Perry moment.
That's right? Fine. But I want to interject.
Something about scriptural ignorance.
Right.
And religious belief.
It's not just the fact that when you take that passage and don't read the next one, it completely changes the meaning of the general context. But also, I mean, I know you know this, but for our viewers, the whole concept of abrogation is, I'm astonished how many people, whether they be Muslims or non-Muslims, have absolutely no clue about this. Right.
And this is actually something that I learned about very late as well.
Oh, there you go. Do you want me to explain it, or do you want to explain it?
No, I know. Abrogation basically means that if there is a verse that came after a previous verse, because the Quran was revealed allegedly in succession, like in over a long period of time. So the revelations came down different times. And One thing I like to like an analogy is let's compare sort of the career of Muhammad to the career of people like Gandhi and so on, in the sense that they started out as rebels, as, you know, peace and love for everybody, humanity, justice, equality. They had that. And if you, so the earlier verses that came down when he was going through this phase, when he was in Mecca, were the more peaceful verses about the peace and equality and justice. And then later, like Gandhi, Gandhi eventually became a politician, a statesman, you know, and he was hardly a rebel, and he had like wide support. The entire country loved him and so on. So now he was an actual politician. He became part of the establishment. And that's what happened to Muhammad when he went to Medina.
Right.
You know, and suddenly he became a statesman, he became a politician, and any statesman, politician at that time was also a warlord. This is 7th century Arabia.
And the revelations became a lot more sinister.
Yeah, they did. And they became very convenient too. There's a verse, there's a verse in the Quran when he was actually having an argument with two of his wives.
Yes.
And that showed up in the Quran.
Yes.
Well, so there are things that were sort of like opportunistically show up at certain times. And if you read the Meccan Quran, I mean, that's why the book is full of contradictions. And when it comes to the contradictions, I think, and I also argue this in the book, settling the contradictions is a lot easier for people with literal interpretations of the Quran than it is for the sort of the ones with the peaceful interpretations. Because a peaceful interpretation, people have to look at the really violent stuff, like beat your wife, behead the infidels, slay the polytheists, and so on. And they have to find a way to rationalize that or interpret it away,
right?
In a way. And but for the fundamentalists, they use abrogation a lot, because they know it well. They know it better. They're like, this is a Medinian surah. And the second thing is that for them it's very easy to reconcile the good stuff. Like, you know, feeding the orphans, you know, being kind to your wives, you know, things like all of that stuff. They're like, well, that applies to other Muslims.
Yes.
Apostates, we kill, which is same thing. Feeding the orphans and cutting the blasphemers from our ranks is both in the service of God. They're righteous deeds. So there's no contradiction there. And as far as treating people well, you treat the people, your other fellow Muslims, very well.
Of course.
The infidels, you don't treat well. So there's no contradiction there.
Well, even the concept of innocence, right? Who's innocent is not meant as anybody anywhere, right? There's a very specific tag associated to who's innocent.
This is great. You're going to read this. The whole idea of innocence is, the only difference is really what we think is innocent.
Right.
Like, you know, when Obama, I've written this. This is weird. Like, I'm talking about all the stuff I've written in my book, and the book's not even out yet. But it's just on my mind all the time right now.
Well, you're getting the people excited about it.
Well, okay, I hope so. I think that's what it is. Obama, like, you know, he came out once, and it was after the Charlie Hebdo attack, I think.
Yes.
And he says, there is no faith. Or I think it was something about ISIS. After James Foley.
There's no faith that prescribes the killing of the innocent or something
of
like that.
Of the innocent.
Yes, of course.
And if you think about it from the mind of one of the authors of the Bible or the Old Testament back in the day, he'd be like, I agree with that.
Right.
We don't want to kill the innocent. We just want the non-virginal brides to be stoned at the doorstep of their fathers. Or that asshole working on the Sabbath
to
be killed.
Yes.
He's not innocent. So what it really comes down to is, like, you know, he's not completely wrong. It's just that his definition of innocent. We don't think that someone who sleeps with another man is guilty in this day and age.
Right.
But Leviticus 20:13 says that he is.
Yes.
The Quran says that he is.
Yes.
You know, there's a... And so the definition of what's innocent is what's changed. And to use that, I think, as a... to conflate those definitions for someone to say today, no, we don't kill the innocent in religion. No religion teaches that. I think it's really sinister, manipulative.
Exactly. But which by the way, goes back to our earlier discussion about you know, how do you interpret something, and should you be proposing a action plan that is accurate from a doctrinal perspective? So that's that kind of ties to that, right? Because you really have to have an honest discourse. You know, you can't say, hey, but look, the Quran says this, no compulsion in religion, but then not say that, well, that particular verse has been abrogated by a more violent verse. I mean, if you're going to engage in the mental gymnastics of trying to find a way to reinterpret things, you still have to stay true to the rules,
to the way that you're going to reinterpret them.
Exactly. Right. So in that sense, that's what I was arguing against with Majid, but he didn't want to have anything to do with it. Let me come to a more practical situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I saw on your, we're Facebook friends, so I see some of the wonderful stuff that you write. You recently wrote a post regarding the, you know, what's happening, what just happened in Paris, and then, of course, whether you should be completely closing the borders to refugees or completely keeping them open, as pretty much we have today. And of course, we're facing this problem now in Canada with the fact that the Liberal government under Trudeau has promised that they would let in 25,000 Syrian refugees. Now, I think we will agree on the general thing. I might be slightly more hawkish than you, but before we get to your position and then see if I completely agree with you or slightly disagree, are you familiar with who Professor Salim Mansour is? Do you know who that is?
It sounds really familiar. He writes for, did he write articles?
Or? He writes a lot of articles, and he's a professor at Western University, what used to be called University of Western Ontario. He's a practicing Muslim, you know, committed Muslim, who appeared in front of, I mean, his speech in front of, or his appearance in front of Parliament a few years ago was quite relevant to what we're about to talk about, because here is a Muslim man who is the product of immigration, as I am, as you are. He goes up in front of the parliament and says, people, please slow the tide of immigration from Islamic countries. Now, either he is a rabid Islamophobe who's part of the KKK right-wing nutjobs, or he might be suggesting that there is something to the idea that we might want to be a bit careful in allowing huge numbers of people, many of whom are the loveliest people in the world, but many of whom may not share our values of liberty and, you know, freedom of speech and all the other wonderful secular liberal values that we have. So with all that background, how do we contextualize what I just said in light of the latest realities and the 25,000 Syrian refugees? Hit me, Dr. Rizvi.
So first of all, I'll say I don't agree. I don't disagree with majority of what you've said.
Okay.
Actually, completely. I think that the process for admitting refugees into Canada or into any country, or, you know, any kind of immigration, it requires background checks. I mean, I'm an immigrant. I didn't come to Canada until I was 24.
Right.
Right. So I came here as an adult. I was, you know, it was before 9/11.
Yes.
Right. But so I came here as an adult myself. And it was a rigorous process at everything. There were background checks, there were criminal checks, there were multiple interviews, there were like 1 or 2 years of waiting. You know, I remember my mother went to Seoul, Korea to do an interview, and then we had health tests. We were completely, you know, everything. It was very, very rigorous. And I think that that is fine. I think that's essential. I don't think that any, you know, but I don't think any refugee, immigrant, or anybody else should be coming here to Canada without any kind of, you know, rigorous background check. I mean, both of us know Faisal Al-Muttar, right?
Of course.
So he, same thing, he is a refugee. You know, he came here, he came to the U.S., right, after waiting for a while. And he was in Lebanon, he was in Malaysia, he was going to all kinds of places. And he was running for his life.
Right.
You know, he was being pursued. His brother had already been murdered by Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And he was under a lot of danger. And I know my wife was actually, she knew him back when he was in Iraq, when they'd been, you know, talking for a very long time. So, and he himself will tell you that, you know, he understands, he agrees with the background checks and the rigorous, you know, exam of anybody who's coming here.
Now, before you go on, let me just interject. I love the fact that you said that it was so rigorous in terms of the process for you, as it was for many other wonderful people who came here. So then how do we take that reality, where for one person to be cleared requires several years, as I have stated, and I'm glad that somebody else has corroborated that, and now let in 25,000 people in 2 months?
Well, it's a matter of circumstance. So what I'm saying is something that happens for individual refugees like Faisal, right? That happens as well. But in some cases, the situation is more time sensitive, right? So in cases, first of all, 25,000 refugees, I think he said originally, I heard in December, right?
Before
December?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. That's a tough one for me. Like, I don't, unless there are amazing resources to be able to, you know, do that. I mean, forget about the whole terrorism risk. I'd forget about the Muslim majority country. It doesn't matter. And if they were coming from anywhere, right, I think that that is just demographically in terms of resources and everything, that's a really tough problem.
Yes.
But going back to the idea of timing, yes, you know, I went through a more rigorous process. Matar went through a more rigorous process. But there were, when these Bangladeshi bloggers were being hacked, and there was a list that came out with 80 of them, then Faisal's movement, the organization he works for, movements.org, they actually helped get another blogger who was on that list safely into Sweden.
Right.
And they did it within a matter of, I think, weeks or months. Right. I'm not sure exactly the time frame was, but it was really quick.
Right.
Because the situation, that circumstance was emergent too. Again, that was one person, but there could have been more. And sometimes you have humanitarian crises where that is, you know, something that you need to do. And some countries can afford to do it, other countries can't, depending on the resources you have. So I don't think it's a yes or no answer.
Right.
The only thing I meant in that Facebook post is I'm seeing a lot of the stuff from the there's this view on the right that, you know, they're all, we should not be taking any terrorists at all. Like Donald Trump and Chris Christie and, you know, all these guys, what they're saying. And then on the other hand, you know, you have this view on the left that, you know, let's just open the floodgates, let them all come in.
Well, and I think what's really spooky about, I mean, it's the first group of guys are obviously idiotic because out of 25...
That's my only... Yeah,
here's the thing. Because I've engaged some of the regressive types, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that you simply say that statistically speaking, when you've got 25,000 people, surely you must expect that there will be more than zero and less than 25,000 that will be really nasty folks. Now, we can debate statistically what that number is, but how many are you willing to let in of that number and feel comfortable with it? And their response is that merely stating this is a violation, right?
You're right about that. You're 100% right, because it's the same. It's like, on one hand, like, you know, they have a point that's similar to the Donald Trump thing. Where it's like, you know, Mexicans are coming in and they're rapists and they're murderers. Right. So that's obviously not true.
Right.
But it's also not true that out of all the Mexicans that are coming into the U.S. illegally, like, there is going to be, as you said, zero criminals or zero people who are not going to be nasty. And this applies to anytime you let large numbers of people in, you're going to have that issue and you're going to take that risk.
Right? Although I think there's a slightly additional issue. I think a lot of people focus, and here I think it'll be very important for you to comment on this. People focus on the ISIS guy. But that's not the only danger, right? There could be, and I mean, Sam Harris uses the concentric circles, right? You got the jihadists, mm-hmm. then the guys who this, then the guys who support them, and then the guys who are silent and their complicity. So let me draw an analogy before I come to my point. Mm-hmm. One of the important elements of mating, whether it be humans or others, is something called assortative mating, meaning birds of a feather do flock together. It's not that opposites attract. When it comes to, for example, shared values, shared beliefs, so if you look in the human context, people tend to assort in a mating sense with like others. And at least if you're trying to predict the quality and length of the long-term relationship, being alike is a predictor of staying together long. So that's the analogy. Now let's link it to, instead of two people coming together for marriage, people from two different cultures coming together. If the people who are coming in, and certainly 25,000 of them, share fundamentally your values, then statistically speaking, I will expect that migration to go a lot smoother than if the 25,000 people who are coming don't share many of your values. So it doesn't require for us to discuss how many ISIS guys are within the 25,000 to be worried. Even if ISIS didn't exist, we've never heard of ISIS or Al-Qaeda. The fact that you may not share our values when it comes to equality of religious minorities and of gays and of women and of animals and freedom of speech and freedom of conscience, that's a problem. So that's a conversation that simply has to be had. We have to have it. I mean, sure.
No, it is true. I just think that, I'm not, again, like I'm saying, and I even wrote this in that Facebook post, that I think that, you know, background checks and all these things, right, that they're very, very important. But in addition to the one or two really, really nasty people that you're going to be getting, there are also the Ayaan Hirsi Alis that you're going to be getting. There's also going to be the Faisal Muttars that you're going to get. There's going to be the Insaf Heather, who is a refugee, and she lives in Quebec, and her three kids.
Yes.
When Raif Badawi, hopefully when he's released, and yes, you know, we're working the way that happened, if he comes here, he's going to come here as a refugee as well, right? So there are you have both ends of the spectrum.
Yes.
The problem is that it's a matter of prioritization, right? There's going to be a risk. You're always going to let these Paris attackers. I think only one of them that sneaked in as a refugee, and right, he used to live in Europe before too, as far as I know.
Yeah.
So the others, many of the other ones, the 7/7 attackers, right? These are the guys who did the Boston Marathon, yeah, Faisal Shahzad, who tried to blow up Times Square. I mean, these are all people who came to the U.S. legally.
Right.
They didn't come here through the refugee channel, and they didn't come here through the Donald Trump illegal immigrant channel either. I mean, they all came here completely legally, and they caused chaos.
Yes.
Right. So, I think it's a difficult question. I don't think it's a question that should be dismissed. I don't think that, I think this is one of those things genuinely where you have the pluses to it, like the refugees that come in. And these are the people who've lived in those countries and who can, it's like having a defector in a way.
Exactly.
You know, the defector is like a really bad connotation, but you know, they're the people like myself, people who've come from there. They've seen that, they've lived under it, and they can come here and they can tell you, and they can be the people to be, they can be the face and the voice of where things should go from here. Because if they don't do it here, they can't do it anywhere else.
Right.
You know, why don't we hear from secularists in the Middle East? Why don't we hear from atheists? Why don't they speak out? And a good reason they don't speak out is because they're either locked up in their bedrooms and they're too scared shitless to say anything, or yeah, they're in prison being flogged like Raif, or they're being executed.
Right.
It's the only way that you can have those people actually speak out and get their message across to the world, and that's the only way you're actually going to be able to fight these people as well.
Right.
Is through channels like the refugee channel. I mean, that's my argument.
But I think
I was saying by no means does that mean that we should, without the resources or without the rationale, without the background checks, right, we should immediately take in like tens of thousands of people within a month. I think that that's reckless. I think that's risky. And yes, even in that case, I think that you will get probably a few people here that will become voices to speak up against, right, all the atrocities there. But at the same time, you could also get somebody who could come here and cause chaos. I mean, those are the risks. I mean, that's just my general position. Right.
No, but I was going to say that, you know, the just this little snippet that we just had is a manifestation of how people who are reasonable can just debate the pros and cons without impugning one another, without questioning whether we're each devils or not, whether we're Nazi big. I think one of the things that I hope to be able to achieve with a lot of these conversations that I have with folks like you and many of the other folks that are within the space is, you know, the fact that we, you know, people have to learn. I mean, in many cases, I tend to agree with my guests, but on some issues, I tend to disagree. And that's what was disappointing.
That's good.
Exactly. That's what disappointed me with Majid, in that it would have been nice to get together and say, look, here are the 95% of the things that we agree, but here are the 5% that we really disagree on. And let's drill down and see if we could come to some common understanding. And I think one of the things that's been very frustrating for me when I operate in the public space is how quickly things degenerate. And of course, it's not usually coming from me. It's where the other camp, the minute that you say anything that they disagree with, the conversation ends. It's rape. It's genocide. I am right. It's you're killing them.
Hitler.
You're Hitler. I'll just tell you a great example now. Just happened to me today. and to move away slightly from the Islam issue, a Forbes journalist wrote an article that appeared on my Twitter feed. I don't follow her. She doesn't follow me, but you know, it's through the Twitter sort of connectivity.
Yeah.
And in that article, which I clicked at very quickly, she was talking about the social construction of toy preferences, right? Now, I've written and also presented the evolutionary and biological roots of toy preferences. And I use all kinds of very, very rigorous scientific evidence to demonstrate how there are certain biological markers when it comes to toy preferences. I mean, across species even. Okay, and so all I did was, is I sent her, I said, hey, whatever her name is, you know, you might want to check out this clip. And I just put my clip where I provide that evidence. It's one of my sad truth clips. So she writes back, no thanks. And so I write back, I say, yes, it's much better to ignore scientific evidence if it goes against whatever you're saying. Well done, good job. So then she writes back, but I mean, who the hell are you for me to... So then now she starts, right? So then when she takes it to that, now this is a journalist who is at Forbes. I'm writing to her as an expert in the field, not to even critique her, to say you might want to look at this biological angle. Then she then starts tweeting about me that I'm a right-wing bigot. I mean, I don't know how we got to right-wing.
Well, suddenly she knows you.
Right. Now,
so I was like, who the hell were you?
Right.
And now, like, it's like, oh, I know everything about
so
you.
So then I decided that, oh, okay, if she's going to play that game, I'm really not the right guy to play that game. I spent the next 2 hours doing the reverse social justice warrior game on her, where I argued that I am a fat Arab Jew. And so the amount of hate I am receiving from this Nazi bigot, because she hates overweight people, she hates people from Arabic countries, and clearly she's anti-Semitic, guess what? She ran away. Because in that game, she couldn't win against me. She couldn't win against olive-skinned Jew boy, fat boy. And so the only way that I was able to get her to probably not gang up on me with all of her social justice warriors is that I held the higher victimology poker hand.
Now, well, I'll say something right now.
Please.
And this is something I tweeted out a while ago. And I think that the biggest privilege in the 21st century is a sense of perpetual victimhood. That is the more you can do that, like, the, you know, they tell you to check your privilege. I think that, that can happen. I have just, this whole victimhood competition that I see, and I don't mean genuine victimhood, like genuine people have been through it. And you can have genuine victims who have this, and you can have people who are not, who have it. But there's this idea, you know, that, you know, you have been victimized. And I rarely ever see this from people like Faisal, who was like on the run for his life at a very young age, you know,
around, I escaped execution in Lebanon.
Well, see, there you go. Like people who've actually been through this, right? Or the people who've actually grown up in places like that. Like, people tell Lishba, like my wife, they keep on telling her that how privileged she is. And, you know, she came from a really, really modest earning family. And she got a high school scholarship, the UWC scholarship, which is United World Colleges, right, with Nelson Mandela as president. The one, the same one that Malala Yousafzai got.
Right.
And she went to a very prestigious private school in BC. And it's the first time she'd ever been on a plane, right? Wow. And before that, and it was completely, purely through merit. And, you know, and that's how she ended up here. But there's these privilege conversations, they never end. And so I just tend to ignore them. The other thing is, like, you know, on Twitter, and I just tell people, I'm like, you gotta, there was a time, you know, back when we used to write letters to the editor and, right, mail them snail mail and everything. They chose which ones went on, which ones didn't. Now you have, like, people sitting in their underwear in the basement of their mom's basement, just writing, you know, stupid shit anonymously. And you just can't. You cannot sit and argue with these people.
So true.
And some of them do. I know that this was a Forbes journalist, but I've just seen overall that when you they usually tend to expose themselves.
Yeah,
like, the people who are very angry. And they go around blocking everybody, eventually end up blocking everybody.
And she actually blocked because everybody started, she thought that I was instigating a mob thing on her. I didn't tell anybody to write to her, but people who happened to follow me were so angry at, you know, her behavior, right? I can't tell her anything. She started arguing that I'm going after her because she's a woman, right? I mean, really, like I can't share my scientific knowledge that might be critical of your position, lest I might be accused of being a sexist, right wing bigot.
You're mansplaining.
I'm a mansplainer, exactly. So people started ganging up on her.
Yeah, that's a word. Yeah.
And she blocked everybody. And so people started tweeting to me that, oh, good, I just got blocked. So, I mean, think about that mindset. Now, this is not somebody who's sitting in their underwear in their mother's basement. This is a Forbes journalist. So when a person in that position could feel completely normalized in that behavior, right? It's totally okay for me to engage this way, right? It's not something that I'm shameful about. That's when we know we've got to take over the discourse. And that's why guys like you and many of the common friends that we have are so important to our conversation.
No, I mean, I know. I think the biggest disservice that this does is to people who are actually in that situation. Like, you know, when I was saying safe space.
Right.
And I'm saying that now when we say it, the word is a joke.
Right.
But for a lot of people, that's a very serious thing. I mean, for somebody like Raif Badawi.
Yes.
You know, the safe space is a very real idea, and it's a very real thing that they need. I mean, for many, you know, when she calls you a misogynistic pig or accuses you of mansplaining, there are many misogynistic pigs out there,
right.
Genuine ones. There are many men who like to mansplain to women and do that. And by making that word, using that word against anybody who just remotely disagrees with you, you're diluting the meaning of the word. And you're actually letting the actual assholes get away with what they do.
So true.
And robbing them of credibility. So a lot of times, people like this, who are so frivolous with their labeling and accusations against people, they do more of an injustice to, like, you know, women who do that do more of an injustice to other women in a way who are actually going through those things.
Let me jump on. I'm sorry, go ahead. Finish your point.
And I mean, it's the same thing with any kind of minority group, any kind of group that's persecuted and so on. I mean, when you... when you use words like this, like heavy words like this, like abuse and bigot and things like, when you use them so casually and on every sort of, even if it's like a really remote or tangentially related reference, you know, even if you use them so loosely, then they lose their meaning. And the people who actually do undergo a lot of, they're on the receiving ends of these things legitimately. It's not fair to them.
Well, let me just give you another example, and then we could wrap it up if you want. Because otherwise, we could go on for another 5 hours. It's so much fun to chat with you. I discussed this actually. Yeah, thank you. I discussed this, I think, maybe with Dave Rubin last week. About a month ago, I came across a website where this lady was proposing a new bill be passed in the United States for something called, because you were talking about how you take a word and you misappropriate it in such a way that it becomes meaningless. Well, nothing could be as serious, or very few things could be as serious as rape. Now, she's got this movement where she's trying to pass a law as rape by fraud. What basically this means is that and of course she very much means men to women, if a man is duplicitous in his pursuit of a woman, so that he misrepresents his identity and then sleeps with her under that false premise, that is a form of rape. Rape by fraud that should be punishable by 10 to 20 years in prison. So
I saw a case like that in, I think it was in Israel,
where he pretended that he was Jewish. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, he said that he was Jewish, but he turned out to be an Arab or something.
Right. I've heard of that case only because of this story that I'm telling you.
Right, yeah.
And so I had done a Sad Truth clip where I critique this position. I didn't refer to her by name. I mean, I put at the bottom of the descriptor the actual website, because people should have access to the actual reference of what I'm talking about. So somehow she finds out about this, and she starts going wild after me. She creates a website where I am the rape by fraud enabler, because she's trying to now shame me. And then when, of course, that doesn't work, because I'm not really one who succumbs to these tactics, then she says that she's going to sue me for defamation. Because in her mindset, critiquing her public idea was defaming her, right? So she didn't do what the ISIS folks did, which is, you blaspheme, we cut off your head. She was either going to cut off my reputation, that didn't work. Then she was going to cut off my wallet, but that wasn't going to work. But it's the same mindset. It's an inability to tolerate that others might have viewpoints that are different from you. Her position was sacrosanct. You mm-hmm. can't critique it. If you critique it, then you're blaspheming against her. It's mm-hmm. It's astonishing, right?
No, we were having a conversation. I think it was a friend of ours and came in and, there's another couple, you know, they're a friend of mine and Alishba's, and they were talking about the girls, right? They were talking about how they, every time they get go out on the street, they get catcalled. And I believe that. Yeah. I've seen it with other people. Like, I know that it happens, and it happens. And she's saying it happens more frequently than you think. But then a lot of there's some men, I think, and this guy, like her boyfriend, he just didn't believe it. He's like, I don't think it happens that often. How could it happen that often? And our first instinct is to think that he is denying
right
sexism, so he must be a sexist. But the other angle is that he's thinking, I would never do that.
Right.
None of my friends would ever do that.
Right. True.
So how could it be happening so often? So what you've done essentially is you've identified a person as a misogynist or sexist who is actually quite the opposite
of that, right.
It's not their fault. It's not the women's fault for thinking that way, because this stuff can get very acrimonious and people can argue, and then in reaction, like sometimes, you know, the guy will start saying misogynistic things, right, and that may turn him into somebody who's more sexist later on. So it's a very complicated situation, because the women are not wrong in feeling upset when he says that. Like, they're right. Not. They're completely justified in feeling upset when he denies what their real experience is. But at the same time, you know, he's also not that kind of right. That kind of person. So what you have is, because of this whole accusatory thing, and because, you know, people get very emotional and reactive instead of looking at what someone's saying, you know, look at why they're saying it, right. What the background is. And when they don't do that, that's the kind of thing that kills discourse,
I think. Exactly.
A lot of times. A lot of it has to do with emotional reactions. And when it comes to emotionality and sensitivity, I mean, the internet right now is just one big, huge pierce nipple. Like, just, you know, just sensitive. There's a lot of sensitivity out there. And I think I try to stay away from that. There are people who get angry, and the moment people get angry, I stick to the argument. If they're not sticking to the argument, I just walk away.
Yeah.
I can't, because you don't have time to, you know, you can't do that.
You know, I sort of oscillate between being very disciplined in not getting sucked into these arguments, but then somehow someone finds a way to piss me off enough that they find the right trigger.
It has to be called out sometimes. Yeah, like sometimes exactly. When there is, like, you know, if John Kerry's coming out and saying that, well, I don't know if you saw this today, but
Kerry
said that, you know, the Paris attacks this time were mindless, and they weren't like the ones, the attacks on Charlie Hebdo.
Yes.
You know, at least at first he said legitimacy, and he's like, well, no, not legitimacy, but rationale.
It's unbelievable.
And I get what he's saying. I understand. Yeah. He says that, okay, there's a connection you can make. But to think that this stuff was senseless when there is also a connection you can make in between, like, you know, what they say, you know, you're bombarding our lands and bombing us, and now we're retaliating. That's also a connection. But in no way does it justify it. So I know he's not justifying it, but he is kind of, in a way, making excuses for it.
Right.
So, I think these things happen a lot, and I don't think that that's why I like, you know, Joe Rogan. I mean, both of our we've both been on the Joe Rogan podcast. I think one thing I really like about it is I like the long form.
It is
podcasting. I do a lot of podcasts because I actually enjoy the fact that you can, like, you know, this whole conversation we had about that. When I told you about that guy who, you know, whether he's really a misogynist or the girls are...
Right.
If I had said even a fraction of that on Twitter...
You're dead.
That's it. That's it. You're done. You know, you can't have conversations like this. So,
right.
On certain forums. So,
well, on that note, let me end it with a very... by tying it to the 25,000 refugees, let me go on record in saying that if the 25,000 refugees... are one-tenth as lovely as you are, then let all 25,000 in tomorrow morning. But if not, well, let's be a bit careful.
That's a lot of pressure. That I don't know. Like, I, yeah, that's a lot of pressure.
But listen, but
thank you very much. And yeah, likewise. I mean, this is it's been a great time. I've seen you on Joe Rogan, and I was completely like transfixed. Just everything that you do, and like, you know, if we could actually start talking about your field, which we didn't get a chance to do that much. I mean, we could go on again for another 5 hours.
Well,
it's absolutely fascinating. So
thank you so much.
Yeah, so I've always enjoyed everything.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you so much. So listen, let's end it for now. Do you want to plug anything that you think I should include in terms of in the descriptor for people to go check out your work? We talked about the Huffington Post. Is there a website that sort of has announcements for your book, maybe?
No, it's just the we talked about the book. It's The Atheist Muslim.
Okay.
And it's coming out at St. Martin's Press in Macmillan next year.
Okay.
And it's being released worldwide.
What percentage of the book is dedicated strictly to me, roughly? About 50% of the book?
The book, the whole reason I was writing the book
is for me.
Right.
Okay, makes sense. Makes perfect sense. So is there any other organization that you'd like to plug that I can maybe help promote or anything?
I can't think. I'm so terrible at this.
I'm trying to plug your stuff, buddy.
I need to get in touch with my opportunistic side.
Well, come on. Do better marketing, man. Come on. People say, oh, but don't do self-promotion. I say, self-promotion is called marketing. What do you mean self-promotion? I mean,
I talk a lot on Twitter. Right. I tweet here and there, as you know.
Yes, of course.
I'm on Facebook. My Huffington Post article archive is huffingtonpost.com/Ali-A-Rizvi.
Okay.
And I think that's it. And I'm writing a book. All the focus is on that. I think it's really important. I am taking it very seriously. I still get emails from people around, like closeted people who can't speak, writing to me, like, you know, gay people in Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
Or, you know, hijabi women who are non-believers, you know, living in Indonesia. I've heard from Indonesia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, everywhere. And they just tell me, like, can you talk about this? Can you mention this? We really need you to let everybody know that they're getting this wrong, and can you correct this, and so on. So that's why I do it. So it's a very important book. It's very personal to me. It's very close to me. About half of it is memoir based. So it really talks not only about, you know, what the ideas are, or, you know, but also the experiences that led to them.
Right.
But there's also the perspectives of other ex-Muslims, or, you know, even questioning Muslims. And, you know, some of the struggles that they've gone through. So, you know, I've talked to a lot of people, and I am just very, very, I'm really looking forward to putting this book out there, because I think that it addresses a lot of things that are not being talked about.
Well, I'm sure it will be a smashing success. And please don't get all haughty on us when you become a huge bestseller. Remember that we knew you before you were famous.
Oh, and I wish I could be a bestseller on something else. Like some. A book that was more just fun, you know.
Right. By the way, and in a future podcast, we'll have to talk about your music career as well, which is very interesting in of itself.
We'll do that.
That'd be great.
I'm not working on anything until February except for the book.
Got it.
After that, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, buddy. I'm going to stop the thing now. Stay online. Thanks, guys, for watching. Thank you, Ali. We are stopping it right now. Cheers.